supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. The National Transportation Safety Board cites Amtrak today for having lax safety standards contributing to an April 2016 derailment. That accident killed two rail maintenance workers who were on the tracks in Delaware County, Pennsylvania, and injured 39 passengers. More from WHYY's Laura Benchoff.
An eerie silent video released by the National Transportation Safety Board, or NTSB, shows the minute before the accident from a camera mounted on the train's front. In it, Amtrak Train 89 barrels down a straightaway with four tracks near Chester City, Pennsylvania, traveling at 106 miles per hour. The video cuts out as a backhoe on the track comes into view. Attorney Tom Klein represents the family of Joe Carter, one of the maintenance workers killed that day.
The report by the NTSB today is a wholesale criticism of the systemic and cultural problem at Amtrak allowing this accident to happen.
That accident report says that more than 20 factors contributed to the fatal collision, from the lack of simple safety mechanisms to poor communication between maintenance crews. In a written statement, spokeswoman Bethany Toll said Amtrak has already taken steps to improve its safety procedures following the incident. Klein says many of the safety findings were unsurprising, having come up in earlier reports.
This is something which we had expected as to negligence having caused the tragic death of Mr. Carter.
National Transportation Safety Board Chairman Robert Sumwalt said their investigation found that beyond negligence, bad relations within Amtrak between workers and management contributed to poor safety. Laura Benchoff, WHYY News.
Philadelphia today released its vision for how the city could achieve Mayor Jim Kenney's ambitious target of cutting carbon emissions by 80% by the year 2050. Now the public is invited to comment on the plan, which looks at the main sources of emissions contributing to climate change and proposes ways of using energy more efficiently without raising customers' electric and heating bills. Christine Knapp directs the city's Office of Sustainability. She says the report is a roadmap for how residents and businesses can help to meet the carbon reduction goal.
We put out about a month and a half ago a report that talks about how Philadelphia is going to use our own municipal assets to meet that goal. This report that we're putting out today is how everyone else, all the other stakeholders in the city, residents, businesses, institutions, other legislative bodies at the state and federal level, what they can do to also help us meet that 80 by 50 goal.
Knapp says many residents were dismayed by the Trump administration's decision to pull out of the Global Climate Accord and want to know how their city can contribute to cutting emissions. Rich Free also works on sustainability issues for the city. He says Philadelphia is already seeking bids from renewable energy companies to supply the public sector with emissions-free power.
Really, one of the key parts of powering our future is understanding that to meet the mayor's 80 by 50 commitment, we really need to move to a zero carbon emissions electricity grid by 2050.
City officials say some 39% of Philadelphia's carbon emissions, excluding the transportation sector, come from fossil fuel burning power plants. That's by far the biggest carbon source that could be reduced to meet the overall goal. It's been more than 3 years since the cry, "Play ball," was heard at Camden River Sharks minor league home games. Once considered a linchpin of revitalization efforts, there are new indications that the former Campbell's Field will be demolished. For a look at how we got here and what may lie ahead, I'm joined by NJ.com's Bill Duhart. Bill, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Sure, no problem, Dave.
So take us back at least to May 2001 when Campbell's Field opened.
Well, it was a field of dreams of sorts. They built a beautiful ballpark at the base of the Ben Franklin Bridge, and it was really a kind of a vision of what a ballpark should look like. It came at the end of the Vet for Major League Baseball in Philadelphia, and folks were kind of looking for that kind of small park experience. It came a few years after the Trenton Thunder were established as a minor league ball club in Trenton, and it's one of the major differences is that ball club is associated with Major League Baseball, and it is a minor league affiliate of the New York Yankees. And the Camden facility was an independent minor league system that was not associated with the major leagues.
Above and beyond its utility as a ballpark, to what extent was it planned as being part of a grander revitalization scheme for Camden?
Yeah, well, it came at a time when you had the E-Center that had recently been built, which is an amphitheater that books top-line talent, probably competes with Mann Music Center. Then you also had the New Jersey Aquarium, which was rebranded the Adventure Aquarium a few years later. The thing that Camden was able to do is try to utilize the waterfront as a development area. So it was part of a large revitalization effort, and the ongoing revitalization, despite the challenges with the ballpark, involved downtown Camden with Cooper Hospital and Rutgers and Rowan universities. So there's a huge amount of development, but still the ballpark is kind of up in the air. And one related matter is that Camden put in a application with Amazon for its HQ2 competition, and one of the things it dangled was the property that the ballpark is on as part of parcels that can be developed in downtown Camden for Amazon's footprint.
Though a few years before the effort to woo Amazon, Camden County stepped in to purchase the property and saving it for foreclosure. To what extent is and or was the taxpayer on the hook?
Well, Dave, the taxpayer is really on the hook for the entire project. It was funded in large part by loans and bond issues from a number of public entities, including NJEDA, which is the Economic Development Authority. The Delaware River Port Authority also contributed $6.5 million. The NJEDA contributed approximately $9 million to its original cost, and Rutgers threw in another $2 million, and it was $3.7 million in equity. So altogether, looking at just over $20 million that was dedicated for the ballpark.
And commuters to this day are ponying up an extra dollar crossing the DRPA bridges.
Yes, for that project and other economic development projects.
Now entering the equation is one South Jersey power broker of some renown, George Norcross, who has declared that the site will be raised. On what authority is he making that contention?
His background is as actually he and his family grew up in Camden. His father was a union leader, and he rose through the ranks to that mantle as well. And his brother is currently the U.S. representative for Camden County, and other family members are well-connected as well. So few things happen in Camden County and much of South Jersey without Norcross being part of it.
And he's cited perhaps Rutgers, perhaps Camden City Schools. Has there been response from those entities?
Rutgers spoke to them for our article, and they spoke about their interest in the property. And one of the things that the property abuts much of Rutgers' downtown development in Camden City. The other thing is that the lot there, a lot of students use for parking as well. So it's our understanding that Rutgers is actively speaking to Camden County about the future of the property. But once again, keep in mind, Rutgers is the State University of New Jersey, so you're still talking public dollars there as well.
Bill, thanks so much for bringing us up to speed.
Sure thing. Thanks, Dave.
NJ.com's Bill Duhart on Newsworks Tonight. Pennsylvania is among the majority of states where the legislature is in charge of designing congressional voting districts. But some say Pennsylvania is home to some of the starkest examples of gerrymandering in the country. In collaboration with Penn Live, our Over the Line series will bring you stories in the coming weeks about how redistricting affects communities, starting with the basics from Keystone Crossroads' Emily Previty.
Gerrymandering means manipulating the shape of a voting district to yield the outcome desired by the party in charge. Journalist Robert Draper explained the etymology on WHYY's Fresh Air in 2012, 200 years after the term was coined by a Boston newspaper, referring to then-Massachusetts Governor Elbridge Gerry.
He presided over map drawing so radical in Massachusetts that it included a very strange-looking congressional district outside of Boston that was shaped like a salamander in an effort to appease the particular congressman there. And so this gave rise to the term gerrymandering that we've used ever since.
To this day, politicians on both sides of the aisle seem to be doing their best to make it an immortal turn of phrase. Pennsylvania's most recent map, drawn in 2011, is known as a particularly egregious example.
Pennsylvania is one of the worst states this decade in terms of its congressional map.
Michael Lee is senior redistricting counsel at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law. He helped lead a recent study where researchers ran 20 years of congressional election data three different ways to measure disparities between election outcomes and expectations. They looked at how many seats each party won versus statewide and district vote totals, and they analyzed whether the differences were statistically more attributable to chance or manipulation.
When you look at these three tests, under two of them, Pennsylvania is the absolute worst state in the country. And under the other, it's the third worst state. And so, you know, that's a really strong signal that Pennsylvania, somebody put the thumb on the scale in Pennsylvania and produced a natural result.
Michigan and North Carolina are up there, too. The study also found partisan bias in Florida, Texas, Ohio, Virginia, and Massachusetts, but less severely. So why these states in particular? A few things leapt out from the study. Lee says the worst gerrymanders happen in battleground states. Basically, if voters of different political stripes live among one another, mapmakers have more options. Single-party control and how the redistricting process works also play a role.
When the legislature split, or when you have a governor of the opposite party who can veto a bill, you don't actually have extreme maps. Likewise, when a court draws a map or a commission draws the map, this is really a problem that exists when one party has all of the marbles and keeps those marbles and doesn't involve the other party or independents or other people in the process.
Republicans dominated all three branches of government the last two times Pennsylvania redistricted. At a deeper existential level, onlookers of Pennsylvania politics say the state is ripe for redistricting abuse. Terry Madonna runs the Center for Politics and Public Affairs at Franklin and Marshall College in Lancaster.
40 state legislators over the past 30-some years who've been indicted and convicted of a variety of public corruption charges, not one of them was censured or reprimanded by ethics chamber of the House or the Senate. We could also talk about one of the weakest campaign finance laws in the country.
Madonna says lobbying laws are weak here, too. And Pennsylvania has done badly in multiple good government rankings and comparative studies.
That goes hand in hand with the lack of reform that exists in the state on some kind of redistricting that doesn't have partisanship intimately tied to it.
Advocates believe we'd be better off with maps drawn by an independent commission. California switched to that system of redistricting in 2008 as a result of a direct voter referendum. Based on that, Carol Cunningham, co-chair of Fair Districts Pennsylvania, says she reached out to her counterparts in the Golden State.
Those same groups, when we began our work here in Pennsylvania, said, you know, it would be a really valuable and important and impactful change for Pennsylvania, but we don't really see an avenue forward for you because as I said, we don't have that option of initiative and referendum.
The idea of voter referendum or redistricting overhaul seems to be a non-starter on the Pennsylvania political horizon. So Madonna says the court system is the state's best chance at maps that are fair. And there are two lawsuits pending, one state and one federal. And the state Supreme Court, which became majority Democrat in 2015, has agreed to fast-track its case, giving advocates hope for changes before the 2018 midterms. Emily Previty, Keystone Crossroads.
Readers who merely view the myriad photographs in the newly published book, Philadelphia, Finding the Hidden City, will deprive themselves of the layers of context, laying out how what once was informs what is and what could be for this unique birthplace of the nation. Let's take a tour with two of the authors, Nathaniel Popkin, author and co-founder of the web magazine The Hidden City Daily, and senior writer for the documentary film Philadelphia, The Great Experiment. Also photographer, Joseph Elliott, professor of art at Muhlenberg College and an instructor at the University of Pennsylvania's School of Design. Nathaniel, Joe, welcome to NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
Here's an opportunity to take us from Philadelphia's birthplace to what is now, focusing largely on the 20th century.
You know, this book is a way of looking at the present-day city. This is a book about Philadelphia 2017. And when we look at the city of the present day, we see a city in the present that is in tension always, and uniquely so with its past, but also with the future, the city that it might be, or as I've said, the possible city. And that's the standpoint from which we explore the city in this book, giving the reader the capacity and maybe the terminology and the way of seeing to recognize the layers in the way that Philadelphia has uniquely built up over time in layers. We say it accreted itself. And the way it also uses the city that we, living here today, have inherited, a city that was built by others before us, and we use it as the raw material for our dreams, for the kind of city that we want to live in. And, you know, one thing we really want to make clear here is that we see the city as in its dynamic nature. That is, it is always changing. Cities are always changing of all kinds. So even though it appeared that Philadelphia was left in a kind of stasis and sort of in a large way the material culture of it was, of course it was shifting in all different kinds of ways, economically, socioeconomically. And we want to capture some of that. And how does it get represented in a special way in Philadelphia? One of those ways is that Philadelphians have a real acuity for bringing things along, you know, with them. We don't really ever really abandon things. One of the things we talk about in the book is reading a streetscape and seeing it, you know, it looks abandoned, but it's really not. So as an example, the Globe Dye Works. From the street, in a photograph that Joe took, it appears to be all boarded up, and in fact, inside it's in the process of reinventing itself as a place of contemporary production. So we like to think of this as an inhabited place, not an empty place.
I'm hearing the Bruce Springsteen soundtrack, My City of Layered Ruins. And with that, Joe, how does one, as one would in decoupage, take back the layers to see more of the essence of what once was?
Well, I like the image of the Globe Dye Works that looks sort of boarded up from the outside. If we look at the pictures in the book, the photographs, almost all of them are interiors. Very few show the exterior. And you might say, well, that's leaving a lot out. We don't maybe understand the context of where these places are if we can't see them from the outside. But the peeling of the layers is really trying. What I'm doing there is just getting into these places and, you might say, penetrating within and within the layers and looking from the inside to find out what's really there. There's so much inside these places that, as Nathaniel says, if we drive by, we might think they're completely abandoned or there's, you know, a pile of rubble inside. But then you walk inside, or you are welcomed inside in many cases by the people that own them or use them, and you find this incredibly rich world. So, as a photographer, I find, you know, if I look back at my work, all is in the last 20 years, it has really evolved to where it's almost all interiors. That's what is most attractive to me and what I find I have most to work with. I can create images with interiors that can be the smallest detail, like a set of jars in the old infirmary of the Diston Saw Works with sort of dust on top of them, up to the kind of monumental interior you might see inside the Metropolitan Opera House or the the Richmond Power Station. So there's a huge range of what I can do to make a photograph that evokes, that is evocative about that, about a particular place.
Nathaniel Popkin, Joe Elliott, thanks so much for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Thanks, Dave.
You're very welcome.
The new book is entitled Philadelphia, Finding the Hidden City. I've been speaking with Nathaniel Popkin, author and co-founder of the web magazine Hidden City Daily, senior writer for the documentary film Philadelphia, The Great Experiment, and Joe Elliott, professor of art at Muhlenberg College and an instructor at the University of Pennsylvania School of Design. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, Newsworks Tonight.